Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight to hear Barbara Arrowsmith-Young. Thanks to HarperCollins for making this possible and to Coors Chambers and Westgarth for providing this great facility this evening. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Barbara Arrowsmith-Young graduated from the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and did a Master's in School Psychology at the University of Toronto. She's the creator and director of the Arrowsmith School and Arrowsmith Program, and she's in Sydney to talk to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the latest edition of The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and Other Inspiring Stories of Pioneering Brain Transformation. And the topic for tonight is A Personal Journey into the World of the Brain. Barbara Arrowsmith-Young, you're very welcome.
Thank you, and I imagine, Gerard, you're going to keep me on time, right? So I'd like to thank Gerard Henderson for that introduction and Anne Henderson for organizing this event this afternoon and the members of the Sydney Institute for coming out to hear me talk about what I'm most passionate about, which is the human brain and its incredible capacity for change. And tonight I want to take you on a journey of exploring, experimenting, and engaging with the world, and also a story of human resilience. And it's a story of how I came to explore the territory of the human brain and how I set out on a journey of hope and discovery to try to find a solution to my own very severe and crippling learning difficulties. And I always had felt growing up that there had to be a path out of my incredible struggles and the suffering that went along with having the learning difficulties. And on this journey, I met remarkable people, mainly on the books or the pages of books, that helped me find my way out of my difficulties. And they also helped me set up my first experiments to actually see whether there was human neuroplasticity and whether the brain did have the capacity for change. And when I saw those results, I wanted to go out in the world to work with others that had either the same difficulties as I did or were struggling with other kinds of learning difficulties. And science has taught us that our brain does shape who we are. We have this incredible organ that we carry with us everywhere we go. We really can't escape it. And it's incredibly complex. There's something on the order of 86 to 100 billion neurons that we carry with us in our head. And to put that into perspective, you know, we think about the world's population, somewhere at 7 to 8 billion. There are also several hundred trillion connections that we have in our brain. And again, to put that into perspective, there are more connections in our brain than all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And to me, what's really interesting is we often make the assumption that our brain works the same as everybody else's brain, and that actually isn't the case. Our brain is incredibly unique. There's recent research coming out of Carnegie Mellon University looking at 700 brains, and they're finding even identical twins only share 12% of connectivity patterns. So if you think about somebody that you know fairly well or look at the person next to you and you note that there are physical differences between the two of you, you know, your eye color, shape of your nose, your stature, there are actually more differences between your two brains than all of those physical characteristics combined. So our brain really does shape us and make us uniquely who we are. And to me, what is really very promising is this concept of neuroplasticity, which simply put means that our brain is capable of change through experience, through stimulation, through learning. So not only does our brain shape us, but if we can understand and harness these principles, there's a possibility that we can shape our brains. And I've worked with people as young as 5 and as old as 81. And to me, also what's encouraging is there's neuroplasticity across the lifespan. The person, the 81-year-old made the same progress as the 12-year-old in terms of addressing cognitive areas. And for me, when I began my schooling, this was in the late 1950s, and this was the time that I call the pre-neuroplastic paradigm. So when I started my school, the belief was your brain is fixed, it's hardwired. If there's a problem related to your brain, you need to just learn to accept it and to live within your limitations, because the brain you're born with is the brain that you die with. And so I was told in grade one that I had a mental block, that basically I would never amount to much and that all of my learning would be an incredible struggle. And I feel like I was given a life sentence in grade one of, you know, basically a life of incredible struggle. And the turning point in my life came in August of 1977 when someone handed me a book. And it was on the pages of this book that I met a Russian soldier who was struggling with exactly the same problems that I had. So I'm just going to introduce you to him. So March 2nd, 1943, Vyazma, Western Russia. On this sunny, almost warm but damp day, the soldiers are chilled, their army issue felt boots soaked. Lieutenant Lyova Zizetsky, just 23 years old, commands a platoon of flamethrowers, part of contingent pushing back against the German invaders who are dug in atop the steep and rocky banks of the frozen Voria River. Comrade Zizetsky looks west, where they will soon be headed. He talks to his men, encouraging them while they all wait impatiently in the stillness as they have for the past 2 days. Finally, the order comes to advance. And the only sound he hears now is the clank and screech of armor stirring. In a low crouch, Zizetsky moves across the river at a pace between walking and running over the ice when the enemy begins to fire. As he hears the machine gun bullets whizzing over his head, he drops down instinctively under the hail of artillery. Then he rises and presses on. Then nothing. Zizetsky's next memory is coming to in a tent blazing with light. All I can remember is the doctors and aides were holding me down. I was screaming, gasping for breath. A bullet has penetrated his helmet, then his skull, and has done massive damage to the left occipital parietal region of his brain, leading to a prolonged coma and severely affecting his ability to reason. With damage to this area, the world of making connections and understanding relationships is lost. Even after hours of patient explanation, Zizetsky cannot fathom that an elephant is bigger than a fly. He knows that one is big and one is small, but cannot grasp the relationship between the two. The words bigger and smaller confound him. Since I was wounded, he writes, I've only been able to consider and compare one word with another, one idea, and there are so many different ideas that I get awfully confused. Unable to see the relationships between things, he sees the world as a separate part, or separate parts. Even something as simple as connecting the big and little hand on a clock is now impossible. He no longer understands logic, cause and effect, grammar, or dialogue in a film. For Zizetsky, the words in a movie come too quickly. Before I've had a chance to figure out what the actors are saying, he writes, a new scene begins. The bullet had damaged the part of his brain that receives and processes input necessary for understanding the world. He could perceive properly with his eyes, but could not deploy the brain to link perceptions or ideas, so he lived with disconnected elements. As Zizetsky put it in his diary, I'm in kind of a fog all the time. All that flashes through my mind are images, hazy visions that suddenly appear and disappear. I simply can't understand what these mean. This strange illness I have, he writes, is like living without a brain. So that was his experience. And when I read this book, The Man with the Shattered World, part of it was Zizetsky's journal describing the kinds of problems he had, and part of it was Luria, the Russian neuropsychologist, describing what was going wrong in his brain leading to these problems. And when I read this, I thought, this man is living my life several decades earlier and halfway around the world, because what he hadn't been able to do after the wound, I had not been able to do since birth. And I knew I didn't have, you know, a piece of shrapnel in my head, but I knew now that there was something wrong with my brain. And here are my beginnings. 6 years old, I hear an exchange that fills me with a quiet horror. I've accompanied my mother to an after-school parent-teacher meeting to discuss the teacher's concerns about my slow progress. Barbara, the teacher has explained to my mother, has a mental block, because at that time the term learning difficulty didn't exist, so I was diagnosed with a mental block. As children do, I understood this truth quite literally. Evidently, there was a chunk of wood lodged in my brain, and it would have to be removed. The teacher was almost right. The word block missed the mark, but blockage was pretty close. For the first 26 years of my life, I lived in a dense fog, not unlike Zizetsky's. And for me, what he talked about, not being able to connect ideas, not being able to see relationships, that's what I struggled with. I was now 20, well, when I started this work, 26, and I still could not read a two-handed clock. Because if you think about how you tell time, is you see the relationship between the hour hand and the minute hand. And for me, it was the part of the brain that sees relationships, connects ideas, cause and effect. I didn't understand why things happened. To me, it felt like I was buffeted all the time by a series of random events. There was no understanding of why people did things, no cause and effect. I struggled with understanding humor or jokes because I couldn't understand irony. And so, not wanting to feel left out, I would laugh when other people laughed, but I had no idea what they were laughing about. I was vulnerable to con artists because one of the ways you know you're being conned is you hear the logical inconsistencies in what somebody is saying. For me, there was no logic, so there were no logical inconsistencies. I would have to read material over and over and over again. What Luria talked about, if somebody has a difficulty here, is they can never verify meaning. They live in an incredibly uncertain world, a cloud of the unknowing, because they can never come to a certainty that they've understood something. So I would read a page 5, 10, 15 times, always hypothesizing what the author was intending, but never being certain. So living in an incredible world of uncertainty. And as I write, when someone spoke to me, I relied on his or her facial expression and intonation to get a general sense of what was being said, but I was never sure. In class, how could I possibly know the answer when the question itself was invariably unclear? On exams, I was never sure I'd interpreted the question correctly, and when I wrote my answer, I could never be sure I conveyed the meaning I intended. So I had a phenomenal memory, a photographic memory. So I would memorize all of my notebooks, and I could actually close my eyes and see the first word on my notebook, and I could go through to the last word on the last page of my notebook. So how I got through school was using my memory. And I would see the question on the exam, and then flip through my memory, try to make a match to what I thought might be the answer to that question, but never being certain. So sometimes I did a really good match and I get 90%, and sometimes I did a really poor match and I get 10%. And what my teachers would conclude was that if I get 90%, I must have really studied, but for that 10%, I didn't study. Well, I studied equally hard to get that 10% as I did for the 90. And that's what it's like having a learning difficulty, is you have a brain that's capable and incapable at the same time. So there's some things you can do with ease, and then there are other things with the best will in the world. Either maybe you can do them with incredible heroic effort, or it's possible that that you can't do those things. And for me, studying, this was my experience, sheer blind terror was what I felt as I set out to accomplish a task I knew was impossible. And I used to line all my notebooks up on my bed, and I would kneel down at my bed. And before I started to memorize everything, I knew how hard this was going to be. And I would just cry from the depths of my soul because I knew how much struggle this was going to be. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was putting myself kind of almost in a Zen state, clearing out all of that emotion, and then just would start to memorize everything. And I said, I was different, but I had no idea why. My world consisted of a series of seemingly random events, ones I could not understand and over which I had no control. I was clinging to a cliff by my fingernails, and the only questions were these. When would I fall? Who would catch me? The answers apparently were soon and no one. So what changed for me? I came across, again, that work by Luria and encountered Zizetsky. Because when you're solving a problem, you have to understand the nature of the problem. So for me, now I understood it was my brain that wasn't working in a very specific way. So that's the first step. Then I came across the work of Mark Rosenzweig, a psychologist at Berkeley, who was looking at this concept of neuroplasticity in the 60s and 70s. And he was working with rats. And what he found was if you put rats in a really enriched, stimulating environment, they became better at learning mazes, which is like a rat intelligence test. And then what he did is he looked at the brains afterwards. And he found that those rats who had had that enrichment and that stimulation, their brains had changed physiologically. So they'd grown more dendrites, allowing for more synapses, better neurotransmission. They had more neurotransmitters, enlarged capillaries, so more blood flow, more glia cells. So their brains had changed physiologically as a result of the stimulation, which he concluded had led to the better learning. And at that point, a light bulb went off in my brain, and I thought, if rats have neuroplasticity, surely humans must have neuroplasticity. It just kind of made sense to me. And this was in 1978, and so I started going to my professors in graduate school and saying, I now know what my problem is, it's my brain. And they said at that point, learning difficulties have nothing to do with the brain. I don't know what they thought they had to do with, but at that time it wasn't the brain. And then they said, and even if it did have something to do with the brain, we know that your brain is fixed, so what's the point? I was desperate at this point. I was in graduate school. I was working 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, sleeping 4 hours a night, and I'd now compromised my immune system. And there's research now to suggest that individuals with learning difficulties tend to have more problems with their physical health because of all those stress hormones that affect the immune system. So I was pretty desperate. And also I didn't see a future for myself at this point because everything was so much of a struggle. So I thought, maybe I can put these two lines of research together. If I can understand what that part of the brain does, maybe I can create a task or an activity to work that part of the brain, to stimulate it, to strengthen it so that it will learn the way it's designed to learn. And so I created my first exercise. And what I selected was clocks. Not necessarily that I wanted to get better at telling time, but I wanted to make my brain process relationships. I was now 26, I couldn't tell time, and Lurie had talked about somebody with that difficulty can't make those kind of connections and see those relationships. So I was pretty abysmal. I had to get somebody to help me because I truly couldn't tell time, but after hundreds and hundreds of hours of practicing reading a clock, eventually I could tell time, which was great, but that wasn't my intention with the exercise. And I wasn't really feeling cognitive change, so I kept adding complexity, which is now one of the things we know that drives neuroplastic change. So I kept adding more and more hands to that clock to force my brain to process more relationships. And for me, it was when I came to processing four relationships simultaneously that I know that there was human neuroplasticity. I could now do things that with the best will in the world before I'd never been able to do. I now lived in real time, whereas before I talked about living in lag time. Because I had a really good memory, I also had a verbatim auditory memory. If I was in a conversation with somebody, I could memorize what they were saying, but I never understood what they were saying. So, like a little recorder, I would walk away, and I would play that conversation over and over and over again, and it might take 2 hours, and I might come to an understanding of what they'd said. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. But even if I did, that person hadn't waited there for 2 hours for me to figure out, you know, what was going on. And even if they had, then they'd say something back to me, and I'd have to memorize it and go away and think about it. And now, for the first time in my life, I was part of human discourse. It was so profound. I could listen to what someone was saying. I could understand it in real time. I could make a comment. I could understand their comment back. I could actually have a dialogue and a conversation, which had never been possible for me before. I also now was able to understand mathematics, which I'd never been able to understand before. And I went back and taught myself all of elementary, high school, and college mathematics, and I understood it now from first principles rather than just memorizing formula. So, and I now, I thought anyway, had a sense of humor. Other people may disagree, because I could understand irony. And also, I was no longer vulnerable to con artists because I could hear those logical inconsistencies. And what really surprised me was every night as I drifted off to sleep, because I have a good visual memory, scenes would play over in my mind's eye from age 4, age 5, age 6, age 7. And I would say, that's why that happened. That's why that person did whatever it was that they had done. And I had, up to this point, had a very fractured psyche, a very fractured sense of myself. And it felt, for the first time in my life, I started to integrate those fractured elements and become a whole, complete person. So as one parent said to me, school is just a metaphor for life. If an individual is struggling with learning difficulties, it will affect them outside the classroom door, just as this had affected me both academically but also socially and in relationships. I didn't have relationships because I couldn't understand people. Now I could have relationships and I could understand people. So then I had multiple learning difficulties. That was just one. I had a problem where I couldn't register the location of sensation on the left side of my body. So if I put my hand on a hot burner, my brain would register pain, but it wouldn't register where the pain was coming from. So I would leave my hand on the hot burner, whereas people where their brain is working, they pull it off. And that was becoming a real problem. I was very accident prone and getting kind of banged up and dinged a great deal. And once I started driving a car, by extension, if I didn't know the left side where the left side of my body was, I didn't know where the left side of that car was. So my car was dented and dinged up and banged. So I created a very different exercise to address that problem because it was a different part of the brain and saw those results. And now I can register the location of sensation on the left side of my body. I also had a spatial difficulty. I couldn't construct three-dimensional space inside my head. So as a child, I would get lost in my friends' houses because I couldn't create a map of where I was relative to where they were in the house. I struggled with crossing a street because when you're crossing a street, you're creating a mental map of where you are relative to those cars. I couldn't do that. So I'd walk blocks out of my way to find a stop sign or a stoplight where I knew the cars had to stop and I would be safe crossing the street. Or my other strategy was to wait by the side of the street until somebody else came along and followed them across and hope they knew what they were doing. But things like geography, geometry, anything, organic chemistry that involves spatial construction or spatial relations was incredibly difficult for me. So again, went in to Lurie's work, tried to understand what that part of the brain did, created an exercise, and addressed that problem. And now I can actually read maps. I mean, one way you can tell if somebody has a difficulty here, if they're driving and they have to turn the map in the direction they're going and they can't do that mental rotation, it's an indication of that a difficulty. Or if they can't construct IKEA furniture, which, I mean, maybe that could be the instruction. But if you can't go from a two-dimensional diagram into three-dimensional space, that's an indication of this area. Or what I call the pile people, and maybe everybody knows a pile person. I was a pile person. For me, if something went into a drawer, it didn't exist because I couldn't think into three-dimensional space. So I had to leave everything out in line of sight so that I knew that I had it and where it was. So if you have somebody in your life that's a pile person, they might have this difficulty. And some of these problems are inherited. My mother had this difficulty, as did I, the spatial problem. And as a child, it was very interesting. We'd get in the car together, we'd know where we were starting, and we knew where we wanted to end up, but there were no maps in either our heads. So it was like a black hole in between, our starting point and our destination. And she had a good attitude. She said, it'll be an adventure. We'll get there eventually, which we always did, and never the same way twice. But I asked her when I understood more about these cognitive functions, had this impacted her? And she shared with me that she had gone to university wanting to study chemistry. And in her first year, she was asked to leave the chemistry department because she couldn't construct those molecules. And if we think about cognitive functions, they work on a continuum. Somebody can be exceptionally gifted in an area. They can have average. Someone can have average functioning, mild, moderate, or severe level of difficulty. My mother and I were at the severe end of that spectrum. I have four brothers. One of my brothers has a mild difficulty with that cognitive function. And he did become a chemist and worked at University of Toronto for his career, but he went into physical chemistry rather than organic chemistry because he could construct those molecules, but it was extra effort and energy, so he picked a part of chemistry that didn't require quite so much on that. So what I've learned with this work is there's no part of the brain that's irrelevant. So if someone says to you, you only use 10% of your brain, kindly tell them that that's not the case. Over the course of the day, you use every part of your brain to engage in the world, to learn things, to navigate. So there's no part that isn't critical. And if there's a part that isn't working the way it was designed to, at the level it was designed to, it will have some impact. And certainly, as adults, we probably all know that there's something that we're not really exceptional at. And usually we can find ways around that to compensate, or we just don't go into that territory. With the individuals that we work with in this program, they tend to have multiple areas of difficulty. So they're coming with several difficulties, just like I had multiple areas. And then it's hard for them to compensate because there are too many things that are causing difficulty, and there's a cognitive load. So they walk into a classroom, they're being asked to do things that take them so much more effort and energy than the other students. And certainly that was my experience. So then you start to engage in behaviors that the teachers don't really particularly appreciate. Attention wanders. I spent probably 50% of my grade one class in the washroom because that was a nicer place for me to be than to be in the classroom. But, you know, again, thinking about some of these cognitive functions, they're adults that I work with in this program, and they're adults around the world that come into this program. And I have this thing that I call a cognitive mismatch. I work with a lot of adults where their cognitive profile isn't exactly compatible with what they're doing in their career. So if you think about somebody that has that kinesthetic perception, the difficulty I have with the left side of my body, and their job is to be a butcher. So they don't know where the left side of their body is in space, and they've got a sharp knife in this hand, and they're cutting things. So the first time I met this gentleman that had that difficulty, he walked into my school with his left hand all wrapped up in bandages because he was cutting himself. And he still wanted to be a butcher, so we addressed that problem, and now he won't make that kind of mistake. He won't cut himself. I worked with somebody on the Olympic ski jump team in Canada who had a very mild imperception in the left side of his body. So it wouldn't really interfere with much of what he would do in life, but when you're coming down those chutes at that kind of speed, he would tend to fall with increased frequency to the left side. So again, we address that, and he won't make that kind of mistake. If you go to a massage therapist, you want them to have a really good kinesthetic sense, because if they don't, they'll either overpress or underpress as they're conducting their the massage. And then there are people that struggle with being able to recognize the look of the world, what I call object recognition or the refrigerator dysfunction. This is the person that opens the fridge and says, "Where's the mustard?" And it's right there in front of them. Because they don't hold the look of the thing to match it up with what they're actually seeing. So a person with that difficulty won't like shopping because they'll walk by the object that they want to buy and miss it. They don't really like meditation because they can't visualize in meditation. They can't hold their, you know, the happy place that they want to go that calms them down. They'll get lost, not because they can't read maps, but because they can't navigate using landmarks. They don't remember the look of the place that they've been before. And I worked with a student that I first created this exercise for, and she was studying at the Ontario College of Art, a very prestigious college in Toronto, and she wanted to be an illustrator, and she had this difficulty. So she would draw a cat, and she'd leave the whiskers off, or she'd draw a coat, and she'd leave the buttons off. So it was kind of a problem if you want to be an illustrator, and you can't hold visual details. So we addressed this problem, and she's now won multiple awards in Canada for her illustrations, and she doesn't leave details out. If people know Oliver Sacks's work, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, this is this cognitive function. I worked with an individual who had traumatic brain injury in this region, and the first day he was leaving the classroom, he tried to walk out a filing cabinet because it was rectangular and it had a handle, so it looked to him like a door because he couldn't discriminate all of the visual details. And again, this concept of cognitive mismatch, or what I also call human error. I think a lot of times human error, or what we say is human error, might be a cognitive mismatch. I worked with a student who was doing his residency in pathology at a teaching hospital in the United States. And he was examining a slide with breast tissue. It was somebody that had breast cancer, and they'd had chemotherapy, and they'd had radiation, and that was to see were they in remission. And he knew how important this was, so he was being really, really careful. And he was examining that tissue, and he was just about to sign off they were in remission when his supervisor came and said, "Didn't you see these cells up here? This is cancer." And it wasn't they hadn't seen them, he hadn't registered what they were. So he knew that he had to exit out of his program and work on that function so he won't make that error again. I also worked with a pilot who had a problem with auditory memory. And this, to me, was really worrisome because, you know, he would get the air traffic controller to repeat the instructions over and over again because he couldn't remember them the first time he heard them. So I used to say if I was flying, I wanted to know where he was flying, so I would not be in the same airspace. But, you know, the better solution was address the problem, which is what we did, and now he can hold those instructions and remember, you know, what he's supposed to do. So, and then when I did the interviews for the book, we worked with a transcriber, a transcription service that transcribed all the interviews. And every time I got the interviews back and started reading through, I immediately knew this was Linda that was doing this transcription because she had an auditory speech discrimination problem. It was very clear because she would transcribe what she heard into something that sounded kind of close, but it wasn't accurate. So one of my brothers was joking about my mother and just said, oh, she wasn't cold or evil. So it came back that my mother wasn't yet off the needle. And I thought, like, this woman is doing this job that obviously is really hard for her because she's just listening to auditory information all the time. She has trouble discriminating it. And I thought, you know, how burdensome this job must be for her. And think about if she was a court reporter. I mean, she couldn't hold down that job because she would be mistranscribing information. So, you know, all of these different examples are different cognitive functions that are causing people challenges and difficulty in their lives. And when I wrote my book, and when it was first published in 2012, I had a vision at the end of the book of where I would like to see this work go. And I always thought I was optimistic, but now when I wrote this vision, I thought I'll never see it in my lifetime. The vision was that every child starting in year one in school has the opportunity to have access to cognitive programs. So part of the day they'd be doing cognitive programs, part of the day they'd be learning curriculum, because we learn with our brain, and if we enhance cognitive functioning, it will enhance and improve learning. And I thought, what would that do? It would mean the child by year three or four that would get identified as having a learning difficulty won't, because by year three or four we'll have addressed a number of cognitive functions, and they will never know that they were, you know, having a learning difficulty. The adults that I work with that have that unevenness in their profile, that would get addressed very early on. And I believe any individual can benefit from good cognitive stimulation. In the current version of the book, in the updated chapter, I report on the results from two schools, one in Australia and one in the United States, that are doing what I call the whole cohort model, that are the one here took year one, and the one in the United States year two. And what we're seeing with the year one students doing motor planning, they actually outperformed the other. Sorry, that's my. Tell me to stop. Just really quickly, they outperformed the other three year one classes on copying tasks and copying tests, standardized tests. So 30 minutes a day, cognitive function, they outperformed the other students. Also, five students in kindergarten had been identified as needing reading recovery. They all went into the group doing the cognitive exercise. 10 weeks into the program, not one of them needed reading recovery because it was motor plans not only related to writing, but motor plans with eye tracking and reading. And the school in South Carolina decided year two that they're implementing this. And what they found was when these students finished the 1 year of the cognitive exercise and went into year three on math accuracy tests, standardized tests, they were outperforming the students in year four and year five. And also, they said these students want more challenging programs and problems to address. I mean, they have this kind of determination and really want to dig in and engage with learning. So I think that is what I would like to see of the future of education, is we're understanding more and more about neuroplasticity, more about the brain's capacity to change, is how can we utilize that knowledge to make a difference in the lives of students.
Many thanks to Barbara Arrowsmith-Young. We'll come to questions and discussion in a minute. Before we do, thanks again to Coors Chambers Lethgarth for providing this facility. Our speakers here on the occasion of the latest edition of The Woman Who Changed Her Brain and other inspiring stories of pioneering brain transformation. I'm sure our speaker will be happy to sign copies of the book later, and Nan's got some down there. So if you just come back up here, we'll start question discussion. There's some new people here tonight. You can ask a question or make a comment, provided one or the other is relatively brief. And I think your question can't be heard, I'll repeat it just to make sure it's caught here by Sky News and by our podcast. Now, I don't know much about the brain, actually. The only thing I've read about the brain is the Irish humorist Flann O'Brien, who said the brain is best judged as a sponge, and if you keep drinking whiskey and you keep it moist, you'll be fine. But if you go off the whiskey, it dries out and cracks and breaks away. And, that's really all I know about the brain. But tell me about the reaction to your work, because on the front here you've got an endorsement by Norman Doidge, MD. I guess he's a medical man, unless he's a managing director. But I think he's an MD, he's a medical man, but others are critical. So how do you look at the reaction from the medical profession, positive and critical?
Well, I look at this work as a paradigm shift. I mean, it isn't coming out of education, it's coming really out of neuroscience. And I think there hasn't been a lot of good work in terms of translating information coming out of neuroscience into education. And I think that's where we're moving now. There are a number of university departments that are being set up to look at, you know, how do we bridge that gap between neuroscience and education. So I think, you know, I welcome people that question and, you know, have questions about this work. Certainly, we're doing research. We're doing research at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We're now looking at the brains of students going through this program. We're doing imaging research at the University of Southern Illinois as well in the United States. And the preliminary data coming out of that will be published in peer-reviewed journals. And it's showing the same results from all of the research that we've done for the last 15 and 20 years. So I think in the next year we will have good peer-reviewed research showing what's happening not only in the brain, but in terms of outcomes, in terms of cognitive performance, behavioral performance, and academic performance.
Barbara, thank you so much for such an incredible presentation. And journey that you've been on. You mentioned towards the end the motivation that some of your subjects or clients had displayed, like tenacity and motivation patterns. Could you talk about the motivation patterns?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it probably comes from a number of things. So a lot of students with learning difficulties have learned that effort doesn't lead to success. That's been their experience. I do something for 5 minutes or 2 hours and I get the same result. So why put in effort? Because it isn't leading to anything. Very quickly in the program that I've developed and in all the different exercises, there's an incredible mastery component. So very quickly the students learn that if I put some effort in, I actually master something. And then over time, what they find is they actually start to be able to do things that they couldn't do before. So that's incredibly motivating. I think we all have a desire to master things, and that is part of one of the outcomes of this work. The other piece is these students have what I call a cognitive load. They have multiple areas that are causing them difficulty. So they walk into a classroom, and I say to parents, imagine putting 40 pounds of rocks on your back. I guess kilograms, but I'm still thinking in pounds, and start your daily activities. And very quickly, you'd be getting exhausted, or you'd be trying to think of how to get rid of that backpack with the rocks. And that's these students' experience. So as the cognitive functions improve, that cognitive load lightens, and they can start engaging and participating in the learning environment, which is incredibly rewarding and motivating. And then the prefrontal cortex, the front part of the brain, both in the right and left hemisphere, we have programs for that. And what we see is that improves, it is that kind of mental initiative, that drive, that desire to dig into things. So there are multiple factors that go into what we're seeing in terms of shifts in motivation and engagement.
Hi, Barbara. I'm Rosemary Bishop from Three Bridges, and we've been running the Arrowsmith program there for, this is our second year, and we've seen such changes in our students, from people who've been 6 months at university and not being able to comprehend their reading to being able to go back to university and get distinctions. We're expanding the program now, looking at after-school programs for younger people, but I wonder if you've had any experience with the older brain, because that's the other area that we're really going to focus on in our brain game program that we're introducing shortly.
Yeah. Well, certainly I've worked with individuals across the lifespan, and the oldest at 81. And I mean, I'm very encouraged in what I've seen is there's neuroplasticity right across that lifespan. And I mean, we know there's individual variability in plasticity. I mean, I've seen students at the same age, like 15 years old, do the same amount of work, very similar profile, both make progress, but one moves 4 times more quickly than the other. So there's individual variability in everything, so there is in plasticity. But I haven't seen age, certainly in my work, be a significant factor. So, you know, just keeping your brain sharp is, I think, you know, there's a lot of research talking about how important that is. And so engaging in cognitive exercises would be a benefit.
Thank you very much, Barbara. An amazing talk. Two people from America have had a huge influence in my world. And I was wondering if you'd worked with either of them. One was Temple Grandin, mm. and the other one is Dr. Joe Dispenza, who's worked with epigenetics. Mm. Have you worked with either of them?
I haven't. I know Temple Grandin's work, absolutely, and I think it's incredibly remarkable in terms of, you know, how her brain has worked and how that has led her to her understanding in the work that she's done. I think is pretty remarkable. Epigenetics, I don't know that individual, but I think, again, that has such promise and such hope. I figure if I wasn't doing this work, I'd probably do work in epigenetics, but I don't know that individual's work. I mean, the fact that potentially we can turn genes on and off, I don't know what the implications would be for the work I do. I've had second-generation individuals in the program. So it was students that I worked with, because I've been doing this work for 38 years, many years ago, and then they go out, have a life, get married, have children, and some of their children have had learning difficulties, so they come into the program. So I'm not sure. Obviously, I didn't do anything in terms of this work that changed the genetic structure, but it would be interesting.
Barbara, thank you. When children have learning difficulties, often it can lead to difficult behaviour, troublesome behaviour, when the people teaching them don't realise what's causing it. Mm-hmm. Have you been involved with your program in any way helping those kind of children?
Absolutely. I mean, we have students that walk through the door that have either mental health issues or, you know, behavioral issues as a result of the cognitive difficulty. Interesting, I mean, Norman Doidge, who wrote The Brain That Changes Itself, and who you mentioned because he's quoted on the front of my book, he's a research psychiatrist in Toronto and became aware of my work, I think, in 2000 or 2001, and saw some clients that were coming to him clearly for emotional behavioral difficulties. But when he listened to them, he felt it wasn't actually emotional, it was cognitive that was driving the problem. And that's one of the things, if we could look at some of this behavior through a cognitive lens. So he would refer them to my work, they would go through very specific programs, then they could benefit from the therapeutic process and a lot of the behaviors dropped away. Certainly I struggled with depression, anxiety, issues. I tended to internalize versus externalize, but certainly we see individuals. But once, you know, that the cognitive challenges change, the individual has more resources to then bring to bear on the, you know, the emotional difficulties. I got labeled in grade one as being rigid and stubborn, and I was, but again, not coming from an emotional place, coming from a cognitive place, because it was so hard for me to understand my world. If I grasped something, I held on for dear life. And then somebody would say kindly, well, think about this over here. But I would have to let go of this to integrate this other piece of information. It actually felt like a physical attack, that I was being physically attacked to do that. So I just dug my heels in. But again, it was cognitive, not emotional. I would never have benefited from insight therapy. I could have been in insight therapy for the rest of my life. But because I couldn't see connections or relationships, that would not have worked. You change that cognitive function, and then the individual can have insight. So there's just a recent article that somebody sent me saying that they're looking at a lot of how cognition drives emotions. So I think it's really important that we look at the cognitive component.
Question here.
Barbara, as you know, I'm an Arrowsmith parent. My son has been in the program for 2 years. Could you just explain to the audience about how you've constructed the way that you have a parent-teacher ratio? One of the things that I find especially rewarding for my son is that when he masters a level, as a group, they celebrate that. Mm.
Yes, I mean, it's, you know, when I saw the results of this work and had my school in Toronto for many years and decided I needed to take it out of just my school to benefit students around the world. So we train teachers. We're in 23, the program's at 23 schools in Australia. It's in 7 countries and about just under 100 schools. But I needed to ensure for me that the integrity of the program was maintained. So we have a rigorous training, we have a support system, we have huge software databases that every child's levels are loaded up, and we have people back in Toronto that track all of that data to ensure that the child is moving at the rate that we expect, and if not, then we have a dialogue with the teacher to try to support that student, because my commitment is to every child, or not just child, every individual around the world that's engaged in the program. So we train the teachers, they go back to their countries and to their schools and start working with students. They are trained in the assessment because we don't want to waste a child's time working on an area that isn't one that they need to work on. So every child is given a cognitive assessment that takes about a day that looks at the strengths and weaknesses in their cognitive profile. And if these areas are functioning well, then we're not going to, you know, put them into that program. And then we do a triage. So if a school is offering 4 cognitive slots, Johnny has 7 areas, we'll pick the first 4 that are critical, and then we do ongoing evaluation. And as soon as those areas are up at average, we'll drop them out and we'll add whatever the subsequent areas are. So it's very, very monitored system.
Just to simplify, I mean, if I open the fridge and I can't see the mustard, I mean, how do you treat that? I mean, it's a serious question. I mean, what? How do I? Because I do have trouble finding the mustard. And I'm not asking for a profession, but I mean, how do you? What do you do?
Well, there's a cognitive exercise that I've developed, because again, I'm. That is, we're not teaching you rules of how to find the mustard. We're not giving you pictures of the mustard so you can carry it with you. We're not giving strategies. The goal is to go in and change that cognitive function. So there's a program with Egyptian hieroglyphs, Mayan glyphs, objects, where you have to start visually being able to memorize these objects. And it starts very simple and goes to incredibly complex. And it's working that cognitive function that holds the visual look of objects and of details, and at the end of that, you'll find the mustard, and you'll find a lot of other things as well.
Yeah, I read Norman Doidge's book. Do we have any idea what is physiologically going on when you suddenly understand something that you haven't been able to understand before?
It's a really good question. I mean, we can't understand 100% unless somebody wanted to go in and start slicing the brain, which is a little counterproductive after you've improved function. But if we look at the animal research, the suggestion is maybe there are more, dendrites, more spines on the dendrites, maybe more neurotransmitters through that intense cognitive stimulation that the brain has changed. Some of the imaging work that we're doing with fMRIs now, with students going through this program, we're actually seeing, we look at the students before the intervention and we look at the function of the prefrontal cortex, and there's tiny little red dots, and not a lot going on there. 3 months into the program, much more activation. So we're changing the activation of different regions of the brain to allow them to work. I mean, we may be changing myelin. We're also looking at myelin. We don't know yet. I mean, every scan that's done, I think it takes 22 human hours to interpret one scan. So it's incredibly labor-intensive, this research. And it's underway.
Barbara, thank you. I was wondering if you could just explain the relationship or lack of relationship with attention deficit disorder and attention deficit hyperactive disorder, because it seems to me like they're perhaps polar opposites. I mean, that is often treated by good riddle and medication, which seems to be the opposite of what you're training. I'm just wondering how they apply.
I look at attentional problems, again, they're multiply determined. Like any behavior, there can be multiple factors that are driving that behavior. There's certainly probably the students coming into the program around the world, if they're on medication, by the end of the program, usually about 75% of the students are off of the medication, because now they can regulate their own attention. So in some cases, I believe it's this cognitive load again, that they were asking these students to do things that are incredibly difficult and onerous, so their brain gets exhausted and then their attention starts to wander. As we address the functions, and they start to be able to process information, hold information, remember information, they can engage in the learning process, and they don't have the attentional difficulties. Then we have programs for the prefrontal cortex, and part of the job of that part of the brain is to regulate goal-oriented attention to keep you on task until you've solved that problem or that goal. And if there's, you know, a butterfly over here, you might momentarily get distracted, but it's the part of the brain that reorients you to you know, the direction that you're moving in. So again, as we address that, then the brain starts to regulate and direct attention. So we see those kinds of changes if that's what's causing the attentional problem. There are also students that it's emotional, right? That there's maybe trauma that's happened in their life, so it's really emotionally difficult for them to stay present. And then they need support from, you know, therapists, counselors, a different kind of support than the work that I do.
Barbara, is there any way that children in rural communities can access your program?
Mm. Well, we're now taking one of the cognitive exercises, the one that's related to motor plan, so that motor plan and eye tracking and also in writing, and we're delivering that remotely from Toronto. So we do it by Skype. We train parents in the exercise. So we have people now in multiple different countries that are working on that. And this is our first year of trialing that, and we're seeing positive benefits. So that right now is available. The other exercises, we haven't quite figured out how to do that because they're very complex, and it's on our list of things to try to solve.
Question up the back.
Barbara, in your school, what does a typical day look like for one of your students?
Not like what most typical days in schools look like. My office is on the third floor, so I walk past the classrooms as I'm going up. And I mean, I understand what these exercises do, but every once in a while I shake my head and think, this looks really unusual. So we have 8 40-minute periods in the school in Toronto, and the students, the adult students, are working on 8 40-minute cognitive periods. The younger students are working on 6 40-minute cognitive periods, 1 period of math and 1 period of English, because we just want to keep them in that literacy and numeracy. But the rest of the day, they may be listening to auditory information and trying to memorize it to work on different aspects of auditory memory. They may be looking at computer screen and looking at those Egyptian hieroglyphs and Mayan glyphs, if that's an area that they're working on. They may be looking at pictures to have to interpret them, going through a whole complex process that works on that nonverbal piece, the person that can't read nonverbal cues, so gets into a lot of trouble in social situations because they misinterpret what's going on. They may be working on motor plans, that exercise. So every 40 minutes, they switch to a different cognitive function over the course of the day, and then they filter into 1 period of math and 1 period of English. In our part-time program, which is after school, people come in for 4 hours over the course of a week to work on 1 cognitive function, because the brain can change, but it does not change easily. To make this really profound change, it is a lot of work. So what I've learned is pretty much the rule of thumb is to address 1 cognitive function, you need 4 hours of the cognitive exercise per week over kind of about a 10-month span. I mean, you start to see change progressively. It's usually that 2 to 3 month mark that you start to see change. And when the imaging research started at UBC, I asked the researchers to scan at that 3 month point to see what was happening, was something happening in the brain, because parents start to see cognitive change about that point. Students start to see cognitive change. Teachers start to see cognitive change. And what we found was a lot is changing in the brain at that 3 month mark.
Just a final question. This book's obviously been very successful. What are your plans? More books? More research? What's the next couple of years?
Next couple of years, vacation. No, the next couple of years, more research and looking at how we can deliver this and make it more accessible, so that more children can benefit. That is my commitment. So research and finding ways to deliver the program to make it more accessible.
We have a final
Just on your work in Australia or your program in Australia, can you tell us a bit about where it is and how people can find it?
Maybe I'll ask Debbie Gilmore.
You want me to respond?
There are a number of 20-something schools. It's full-time, part-time, whatever.
So on the website, it's just arrowsmithschool.org. There's a list of what we call participating schools. So if you go into that part of the website, it lists all the schools around the world, and it will list whether they offer an adult program, a part-time program, so people or a boarding school can look at that, and they have all the contact details of those schools, so can then reach out and speak to the people at the schools.
Many thanks. We could go on, but we always have a rule of finishing on time, and the copies of Barbara Arrowsmith's book here, and as I said before, I'm sure she'll be happy to sign them. Well, we've got to wind up, because some of us have got to get home and check for the mustard to see if we're any more successful. Look, thanks for a very challenging and provoking analysis tonight. It made me think about a lot of matters I hadn't really thought about before, and I'm sure that's true of many of the people here, and you have quite a fan club in Australia. I think some of them are here, and some of us don't know that much about your work and are learning about it tonight. So many thanks for a fine presentation of the Institute. Good luck for the latest edition of your book. There'll probably be another edition of that, I expect, but for tonight, congratulations and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.